It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, this is Ben Domenech with the Ben Domenech Podcast. Brought to you by Fox News. You can tune in to all of the podcasts that we offer at foxnewspodcast.com. Today we have a conversation with Elbridge Colby, who is a foreign policy expert and one of the most prominent critics of the existing national security approach by the Biden administration. I encourage you to check out his work. I also wanted to just say thank you for listening to this podcast and for rating and reviewing it. I hope you will recommend it to all of your friends. Our conversation with Elbridge Colby coming up next.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free-fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Elbridge Colby, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Great to be on, Ben. Thanks for having me.
So I want to talk to you about a number of different things related to Afghanistan and the situation that we see over there. But I'd like to start with just getting your own response and critique, if you will, of President Joe Biden's interview with George Stephanopoulos. Because to me, upon re-watching that interview, it seemed like he was giving as strong an argument that he could, that essentially someone was going to have to bite the bullet on Afghanistan, and that no matter what happened, it was going to end up turning into a chaotic scene. What did you think of his remarks? What did you think of his commentary and response to Stephanopoulos' questions on this point?
Well, I think you put your finger on it, Ben. I mean, I think other people have talked about some of the disturbing aspects and the transcript and so forth. But look, I think that's a false point. I mean, I really recoil at arguments that sort of center or focus on competence. I mean, I just remember, for instance, you know, a lot of the initial critiques of the Iraq War when it sort of turned sour were kind of saying that people were incompetent. And I think that's often a cop-out. I mean, look, these are difficult problems in national security. Opponents like the Taliban or Iraq want to hide things. But I actually do think this is a real crisis of competence here, because, look, this was not about the fundamental withdrawal decision. And I think that the president is eliding that, and that's not correct. I mean, I supported the withdrawal decision that President Trump made and that President Biden followed through on. But that's much different than, as my partner Wes Mitchell puts it, the nature of the dismount. That's critical. And that is essentially an operational and logistical issue. That is something that is well in the capacity of our military intelligence diplomatic services to provide, and that the president should be able to oversee. And I think that that has manifestly failed. And it's almost hard to imagine it going worse. So I think he's spinning at this point, and he's trying to deflect and defend himself. And that's what you would expect in those circumstances. But I think it really is a pretty cataclysmic outcome on multiple levels.
One of the things that we've seen as a trend in recent decades is the decline of the faith that the American people place in our shared institutions. And those are governmental and non-governmental. So it's everything from the institutions of the bureaucracy to the institutions of the church, or even sports leagues and things like that. And one of the real few remaining institutions that has been exempt from that decline is the American military. To me, to see the scene that's in front of us, knowing, as I know, as you've said, that this is something that the American military has the capacity to do, and to see it go so sideways, I wonder if that will change. And I think that would be, you know, a pretty bad thing for the country for it to change. What is your feeling on that score? And do you think that we're going to see essentially just a scramble, and we are in the early days of this, of course, of attempts to cover for the decisions that were made and to place more blame on the civilians and the commander in chief?
Well, I do think there's going to be a reckoning for particularly the senior elements of the U.S. military. I mean, I think you put your, you know, you laid it out very well, the decline in faith in American institutions. And I think that one of the things that differentiates people, if I could say, like you and me, and our approach is we try to reckon with that and not blame. I mean, some of the people out there who pose as elites or what have you blame the American people for the problem. And that's not to say everybody is innocent, but I mean, these institutions, you know, when the trust in the media or in political institutions or in the universities or other things like that is at such a low level, that suggests a real problem. And it is a real problem. And that, and they need to, you know, hopefully our democratic system can for that. Sadly, I think there is a reckoning due for the military. And I'm not sure, you know, I think it's warranted. And when I say the military, I mean the senior echelons of the military. I think here we have a situation in Afghanistan where, you know, enlisted and junior and field grade officers, you know, performed miracles often, certainly honorably. And it's not my place to say, I don't have the noble, you know, chest of ribbons. But I think, look, I think this is a really profound failure on the part of this, of the military, the senior military establishment. I mean, some of the most glittering lights in the military firmament for the last generation have been people who have overseen and staked their reputations on very ambitious claims for what was possible in Afghanistan. And they have been not only disproved, but disproved in the most, you know, rapid and kind of catastrophic way possible. And then it's kind of crowned or the reverse. It's sort of the nadir of it is this utter failure of the withdrawal, which, look, this is ultimately the wheelhouse of the senior military. Why weren't senior military threatening to resign if they saw the problem? Mm-hmm. Why weren't they, you know, why weren't they refusing to go to war or lying down on train tracks, the spinning going on and all this kind of thing? And look, there's plenty of blame to go around. Certainly the president and his administration deserves it. But I think the senior military, you know, and other elite kind of national security institutions will also have to have a very hard look. And I think, you know, to be honest, I mean, this gets into sort of broader territory. But I mean, look, I think there's been an almost unhealthy degree of reverence for the military's institution. I think it's fully worthwhile or fully appropriate to honor the service of individual soldiers or, you know, units of soldiers or what have you. But the military as an institution, I mean, I've heard very senior retired military officers speak about civilian life and politics in a way that really chilled me to the bone. And I've always, you know, the line that I always think about is, look, in our country, the divisive and tough politics are the feature and the standing army is the bug. And we create a standing army after the Second World War for particular reasons because nobody else could do it. But, you know, the senior military needs to be held to as much to account as any other institution in our national life. Mm-hmm. And again, I differentiate that from the rank and file, but I think it's probably time for that to happen.
Well, that gets into this broader question about that military leadership, the elite established order that has directed so many decisions in the past two decades that turned out either to be based on false information or too ambitious, as you said, or, you know, simply not matched to the reality of what was going on. There is a real problem, as I see it, of military leadership where this general class that we have has become a political class that is impenetrable in terms of their ability to survive scandal and essentially invoke their military history in order to, you know, protect themselves from the kind of accountability that would be required of virtually anyone who was elected political office or who had who lacked that kind of chest full of ribbons and medals. And that to me is a very dangerous circumstance, because it means that you don't have the level of accountability that you should expect for people's ability to do their job and to deliver on what is promised. And that's something that I've heard about, you know, not just from my many family members who have served, but from my friends as well, that it is a repeated item of frustration from their perspective that there is not accountability there. I've even had a friend recently suggest that maybe we need a BRAC for generals in order to actually get rid of some of these folks. What are your thoughts on that problem as it stands today?
Well, I think I completely agree with the point that there needs to be a very clear accountability. And I think there is a structural problem, which is that nobody in the U.S. military is elected or appointed by the president. And the other thing that I would point out, and I've experienced directly, including in direct contact with some of the key figures who are involved in this imbroglio now, is that there has been a massive grab by elements of the military establishment over the last few years, probably last 5 years or so, to assume more authority at the expense of civilian appointees. And I mean, I'm not a supporter of the Biden administration, to put it mildly. But I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the National Defense Strategy Commission report of 2018, it very clearly identified an erosion of the balance between civilian officials and military officials. And essentially what's happened is that the senior military and the elite and some of the elite institutions have grabbed more power and oversight and marginalized civilian oversight. So all the more reason for there to be scrutiny here. And, you know, if it's just Republican and Democrat office holders and appointees sniping at each other, you're missing a big part of this. And, you know, the same goes for the intelligence community. The same goes for senior diplomats. I mean, I think the problem is particularly acute here in the military because of the cultural reverence for the military. And I think that cultural reverence is entirely due in the aspect of military service and combat and, you know, sacrifice for the nation. But that's essentially earned by people out in the field. This is not, I mean, the last 20 years have not been successful, you know, and I point out to people, look, you and I and everybody else in the country are spending over 3% of our income. We deserve better outcomes here. And this is about, you know, senior military decisions that are only marginally, if at all, affected by civilians. And I think Afghanistan, in a lot of ways, is an example of that. Mm-hmm. So I think, look, I think, you know, what I've said, you know, publicly is absolutely the Biden administration needs to get searching scrutiny, but so does senior military, senior intelligence community, and others.
Let's talk about the intel community for a minute. It was amusing and predictable to me to see the normal folks at the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times having anonymous people run to them in the wake of all of this to basically say, hey, don't blame us. Don't blame us. We were saying, you know, that this could happen and that kind of thing. We obviously lived through a presidency under Donald Trump in which these types of approaches were readily apparent on a near daily basis of these anonymous sources from within, you know, the quote unquote deep state, but, you know, just within the intel community or within America's military were leaking like mad to significant effect. Obviously, one of the most significant elements of this is the Russia Bountygate story, which certainly had some ramifications in terms of tying the president's hands on policy and really perhaps redirecting what could have been accomplished before he left office in Afghanistan, a story that ultimately, you know, proved to be perhaps much less than what it was depicted as early on. This is something that also really concerns me because America wants to be confident in our intel service as being divorced from the interests of domestic politics. But it really seems like that's changed in the past several years. And one of the most significant outcomes of that has been a decline in faith among, you know, the typically pro-military, pro-intel service coalitions of the right in America, which has typically been much more respectful of those aspects of our institutions. How can something like that be adjusted or reconsidered? Is there a need for another commission? Is there a need for something that can reorient America's intel services in a way that Americans can have confidence that they are on the lookout for American interests broadly and not interested in playing politics with our domestic decisions, decision makers, and the civilian aspect of things?
Well, I think one of the most poisonous aspects of the last few years has been the leaking of classified information for political gain, including about specific individuals. And, you know, obviously we've seen it even recently with, Tucker Carlson's allegations and so forth, that, I mean, the use of highly classified information for pointed domestic political purposes is, I mean, almost the definition of, you know, the destruction of a democratic system of government. We cannot have that. I mean, in a sense, the establishment of the national security state in the beginning of the Cold War, and then its kind of overhaul in the '70s, if you will, that was really about bringing it within our constitutional norms. And if there is a system in which people are, you know, leaking, I mean, the bounty story, or, you know, going back to Russia collusion story and so forth. I mean, this is a really very serious. I mean, not to say that there, you know, there aren't legitimate issues, but they need to be worked through the proper channels. Otherwise, it will be seen as political. And I think, I mean, it's really remarkable, honestly, that some of these national security institutions have been able to alienate. I mean, you see leading Republican politicians right now who are, I think, very in touch with Republican voters in the base, and you know, many of whom are veterans, for instance, vehemently criticizing the senior military and intelligence community. I mean, this is a really a remarkable state of affairs. I mean, how do we get out of here? I think because, I mean, like you, I mean, I saw on Twitter, you know, you're pushing back on the notion that we want American authority to be degraded in the world. No, we want American authority and power, but we want it to be used intelligently and for the purposes, I think you pointed out recently, of an sort of an enlightened America first. I always recoil a little bit at the America first language because of the 1930s stuff. But the basic idea is like, look, these institutions exist for the American people. They should be accountable for the American people. And if they're not working for the American people, they should be overhauled. And people who forget that do not belong in senior positions. And there is a very significant, I would say more than a tinge, there is a current of that. And that needs to be really, I would say, frankly, suppressed or pushed back. This is the kind of area where cross party lines, where there are Democrats who maybe want to be more, who have been more skeptical. And Republicans may have said in the past, oh, these guys are bad. But now Republicans, I think, should be open to saying, look, you know, at the end of the day, this is a constitutional republic. They work for the people. You know, now we're living, I mean, you know this better than I did. We're living in a system where people are worried about speech and being policed on social media and collusion with the government. I mean, look, we cannot have a national security state be anything but under the purview of the people's. I mean, I don't say that as a kind of a, you know, kind of try to, you know, whip up furor, but I mean, I think that's that. Honestly, there are attitudes where that is not the case. You know, where there is a blob, and I mean, I don't pretend. You know, I've spent time in the blob. There are a lot of good people in the blob, but as a structure, the blob has really lost the bubble on that, and I think we need to push back. Again, but we, you know, without throwing out the baby with the bathwater, like, you know, you need a national security state. You need senior military and senior intelligence officials who are, you know, focused on that and, you know, have a sort of an elite kind of mentality and the esprit de corps kind of thing. But that always needs to be brought back to their duty to the constitutional system.
More of my conversation with Elbridge Colby coming up next. I'm not an anarchist. The point that I've made, over and over again is we are always going to have an elite, and we should have an elite, but we should demand a better elite, a more responsive elite. And to me, you know, the big some of this goes back to, there was a Bill Kristol tweet like right after Trump got elected where he said something, I believe he said, I prefer the deep state to the Trump state. And I responded to it, and this tweet still gets retweeted today. I said, I prefer the elected to the unelected. The elected, I mean, and whether that's Joe Biden or Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton the elected people who are chosen by the American people are the people who ought to run the show, you know, for good or for ill, you know, and even if that runs against my own, you know, policy preferences. And once you get away from that, then you see the crumbling of the very nature of our republic. And what I'm very concerned about coming out of this is the Biden administration rose into its position based on so much of the argument from the media that they represented a restoration, not just of political normalcy, but of basic competence in government. That the Trump administration was totally, you know, fly by night, you know, shoot from the hip, you know, didn't have any plan. There was no coherence, et cetera. Now, I believe that certain aspects of that are fair critiques, though I think that that diminished dramatically over time. And certainly under Mike Pompeo, I think that there was much more coherence and in a clearer direction. But when you look at that kind of assessment now, if the American people are sold this as competence and normalcy, as if, you know, what we're seeing in front of us, what our eyes are showing us, this is what is now defined by those terms. I don't know what the backlash to that looks like necessarily politically, but it's not good. Whatever it is, it's like, well, if this is competence and normalcy, then, you know, we're going to go in a completely different direction. So, yeah. I mean, can I ask you something personal? Just
sure.
When you think about Afghanistan, what do you think about it in terms of the last 20 years of your perspective on it? How that changed? What changed in terms of your own vision of it? Were you right from the beginning, or was this a situation where new information, new experiences led you to have a different position today than you used to? What does that look like?
Well, no, it's a great question. I far be it from me to claim that I had like a crystal ball at all. I will say, and I've been wrong about a lot of things in my life, but I think one thing I have felt that I've been right on, and you can check with my old friends who were there, you know, we used to have debates about this. I do feel like I had the basic idea right about Iraq and the nation building ambitions in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I mean, I don't want to, the farthest thing from, you know, gloating, because it's sad that I'm, you know, but it's part of the, you know, I think it's kind of, frankly, the last 20 years has really vindicated what I think is a right foreign policy, which would be sort of a conservative inflected realism. That's basically, you know, exactly as you put it, about serving the American people. I mean, what's the American government for? It's provide the common welfare for our citizenry, right? That's the idea. And we help people where we can reasonably, but the notion that we're going to turn Afghanistan into a, you know, indefinitely sustainable, you know, multi-party democracy that's at peace and, you know, all this stuff is, I mean, that's not, A, it was not necessary, and B, it really wasn't feasible. And so, I mean, I just, you know, I put out a tweet yesterday or the day before, actually in response, I was thinking about Crystal in particular. I mean, it's incredible. This guy is still out there. I mean, really, I mean, some of these people have done so much damage. I mean, I've never met maybe I met him once or something, but like, you know, this is not a personal animus, but I mean, come on. You know, like, I mean,
at some point you have to take the L and move on to writing books.
Yeah. And have to be chastened, you know, the sort of Profumo after the scandal, he went and worked in the, you know, the poor areas of London as penance. And it's kind of like, look, we have literally tried your foreign policy for the last generation, and it is epically and manifestly failed. I mean, based on a reasonable set of expectations about the alternatives, doesn't mean everything else would have worked fine and dandy. But I mean, I think it's pretty based on, you know, spending 3-3.5%. If you add up the national security state, that's really not good. Mm-hmm. And I think what you were saying earlier about the Biden administration, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, what I took from President Trump's victory and his basic idea was like this point about the elites and focusing on what, you know, quote unquote, ordinary interests more immediately. And the blob is obviously completely detached from that. And I think the President Trump had a sense of that. And actually in some ways, President Biden does also, although it gets kind of mixed up and there's an incoherence there. But I think there was, you know, I mean, what it was incumbent upon all of us to do is to say, hey, the American people are throwing up a big warning flare that's saying, you know, no mas, we gotta look at this. We gotta re-baseline and we gotta take a different approach in economic policy and trade and foreign policy and national security. And I think one of the problems is that national security, because it's so controlled by this elite, you know, the president notionally, but a lot of it by unappointed officials. I mean, you know, if you go back to the Federalist Papers, it was deliberately created to have a monarchical aspect. So it means it's much less susceptible to democratic accountability. Well, it just kind of keeps going on, you know, and there's classified information, which makes accountability difficult and so forth. But I mean, you know, I think, you know, you look at our trade policy, for instance, Katherine Tai confirmed by a voice vote, there's been a real change. I think in a lot of ways in the national security establishment, there's been much more resistance. I think your point about Biden, by the way, is really on point. I mean, to me, this is a rapier thrust directly to the heart of some of his core claims. I mean, the competence issue, mm-hmm. the America's back and working with allies. I mean, that not only just pulling out of Afghanistan, but also not consulting the Brits. I mean, that's like a pretty basic thing to do.
Tom Tegenhat speech is just, I mean, it's devastating in a way. It just, the idea that you would have such a prominent MP, you know, standing up there and saying we can no longer count on one ally, we have to work more closely with Japan and Australia and the rest. That is not what you want to see in terms of fulfilling any of those promises. And one of the other things that just sticks out to me about all of this is, you and I are kind of the older level of this, but there's an entire generation of people for whom this conflict was a defining experience. And the degree to which there is just sorrow and depression running through those communities right now, frustration and disgust, we shouldn't underestimate that as kind of a negative aspect of what is coming out of this. Certainly, you know, it's not my brother, it's my brother's friends, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. And and one of the things that sticks out to me about January 6th was, you know, the death of Ashley Babbitt, which it got so much, you know, sort of attention, but a lot of people were kind of saying, well, you know, how does someone who goes and serves in the Air Force and, you know, serves honorably and, you know, does work overseas, how do they end up, you know, in a position like this? Well, they end up in a position like that because they feel betrayed, because they feel betrayed by what they signed up for. They don't think that the country is working for them anymore. And they're, you know, as you know, sometimes, you know, these are the same populations that can be very willing to consider that the government is lying to them because they feel like it's you know, about other things, because they feel like it lied to them in other capacities as well. And that's a devastating thing to happen to the class of Americans who have for so long, you know, served so honorably and well in the front, as you've said, you know, doing the work that these elite generals have told them to do as best that they can. And then feeling left behind when they come home. And that's such a devastating cultural element of this. I don't have an answer. I don't know how to turn that around, but I do know that it has to be turned around in order for us to be able to handle the challenges of the coming years, don't you think?
Well, I think that's exactly right. And I actually think this is why it's so critical for the, you know, the blob, but also the political establishment and so forth, and the media and so forth, to actually reckon with this. I mean, the disillusionment, the disaffection that you're talking about is extraordinarily real. People who, and it's highly concentrated among the people who, in a sense, are the most patriotic in the world, the people who carry the constitutions in their, you know, breast pocket or what have you, right? I mean, that is really kind of, I mean, in terms of our social cohesion, our ability to perform in the world, and just the good of our republic, which is the point, right? That's really, really dangerous. And we need to grapple with this. And at the same time, you know, this is all happening. And yet we are now facing the most significant superpower challenge, certainly since the Soviet Union. In some ways, it's unprecedented given China's size and prospective strength. Yeah. And so at the very moment when our society is at a nadir of terms of confidence in elite institutions or traditional institutions of any kind, and in these critical institutions like the military, is precisely when the People's Republic of China is now reaching a kind of a new zenith of power, which, you know, my view is this is very immediate for a national interest. I mean, I thought that, you know, my view is we should have probably gotten out of Afghanistan a long time ago. We should never have gone into Iraq, but those things happen. But now we have a situation in which people are, frankly, with great justification, extremely skeptical about claims of, you know, a national security threat. I mean, you had people, you know, President Bush talking about, you know, if we don't get them over here, we get them here. You know, this sort of, you know, there's no, if there's any instability in the Middle East, we're not safe. And it's kind of like people are rightly tired. But that's exactly when, you know, when we're actually facing a gigantic threat. And I think one of the things that I think you and I share also is sort of like, you know, there's a sort of a false debate often between the people who say there's, you know, the crystals, there's a threat everywhere. You know, we have to challenge everybody, which is, unreasonable and unrealistic. And you waste your effort and so forth. And you do things that you can't succeed in that you don't need to. But on the other side, there's this kind of siren song of come home, America. We don't need to get in these things in the world. And that's in a way, I'm sympathetic to that. But like, that's actually not conservative in any meaningful sense. Not that that's the be all and end all. But it's like, I mean, the world's a tough, powerful place, right? You got to deal with that reality.
It's about choosing the way in which you project power and and making those choices in a way that is in the American interest and does not become wasteful or stretches us too thin so that we cannot handle these significant elements. And so I'm glad you brought up China because it seems to me that we are woefully unprepared for the threat that is there. And I don't know if you read the report commissioned by Mike Gallagher and others concerning America's naval situation, but we really do seem like a nation that is we have generals who are debating critical race theory instead of figuring out how we actually can handle an invasion of Taiwan. It's absolutely backwards, and unfortunately, I don't have a lot of hope that we're going to be able to turn that around in the time frame in which we are offered, in order to confront China directly or even indirectly. And it was extremely depressing to me. For instance, right before the pandemic, I had gone to Hong Kong for a week to cover the protests there, and to see the way that China used the pandemic and the West not paying attention to what was going on to basically sweep in and do everything that they wanted to Hong Kong was just a preview to me of the way that they are going to deploy every tool that they have in order to achieve their aims, and that we are just not prepared to counter them or prepared to marshal the world to counter them in the way that we ought to. Is there something that can be done about that in short order, or is this just kind of a foregone conclusion?
Well, I think there is stuff that can be done. I think you're exactly right to be tremendously worried. I don't think people are worried enough. I mean, I really think that, my sort of gut level sense is that I feel that it can't be this bad, but my mind, based on what I'm reading and seeing and talking to people who really know, is that I think there could be a war in this decade and we could very, very possibly lose it. I mean, I think, look, it's pretty simple at the end of the day. China is an economy of as large as ours. It has been pouring enormous amount of resources into its military, specifically focused on defeating the American military. It hasn't had any distractions. Meanwhile, we've been engaged in these futile wars in the Middle East for no compelling purpose at the end of the day. And I think there's a degree of hubris, and that, for instance, exists in elements of the senior military, elsewhere in the national security elite. I mean, if you talk to the people who really know, say, wargaming and military analysis, they say we really do lose a lot. Now, there are things that we can do to turn this around that involve a very great degree of focus. But, you know, I mean, frankly, the Biden administration has done some good things on their defense budget, but then they're cutting the overall defense budget. They're not making some of these hard choices. They're also leaving time. You know, if we only get our military balance in the Pacific back in 2030, that's not soon enough, because the Chinese may have an incentive to act in this decade. And I think this, the other thing is, there's a lot implicitly, and I mean, there was a guy who worked with me in the Pentagon, a Marine, very distinguished combat record, and he said, you know, Bridge, the difference between you and a lot of Marine general officers is that you think war with China is possible and they don't. And I mean, I just try to think about, like, well, if I'm thinking about America's interest in this way, how would I think if I were in China? And I was like, I have a window in the 2020s. I can puncture the Americans' kind of credibility and myth, you know, especially of Taiwan. But of course, you wouldn't end in Taiwan, right? I mean, why would you? You know, and it's not like you need to go rampaging through the whole region. You just need to show that the Americans are not credible. And frankly, Joe Biden has done a lot already to substantiate that charge. So like, I don't know how much more needs to be done. The problem is for Americans, and I mean, this is the point I really underline, is we cannot allow this to happen because Asia is 50% or more of global GDP. I mean, think about what we already worry about with the social media companies and what our own government may be doing. Think about what the Chinese government can do if it's got 50 to 60% of global market share. You're going to be, the decisions about your economic future are going to be made in Beijing, what you're allowed to say, and they've got, you know, this AI and big data analysis that's going to be able to hold you individually accountable in very targeted ways. It's pretty nightmarish. And frankly, like, I don't need to come up with examples. Just look at what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Right. And the key is we got to stomp them before, you know, because the thing about the Pacific is all the people live on the other side. You know, it's like we can't divide in the middle. We got to work with Japan, India, the countries that have the power. And that's the challenge. And that's kind of my main sort of crusade at this point is like, you know, if we don't act soon enough and we don't act decisively and quickly enough, it all could go south. And a big ton of last point, especially on the Republican side, is there are a lot of people who say, hey, Bridge, yes, China's a threat, but we can't abandon, you know, Europeans or Middle East, drugs, blah, blah, blah. You know, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. False, 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 false. We had 10 years to try that, 15 years. We spent it on Afghanistan. We spend it on stuff in Europe. We didn't spend it on the Pacific. And the military analysis right now says we very well might lose. So we're going to have to do really crazy things for the next few years to get ourselves where we don't have a war. That's my view.
You know, and I share that view, and I'm concerned that more people don't. Let's round up on this. One of the things that happens when you are out of power is that it becomes very easy to demagogue about the decisions of those who are in power. And I've already seen this media narrative being advanced. Well, you know, Joe Biden made a hard decision here. It was always going to be chaotic. You know, these Republicans that are out there, they don't have an alternate solution. You know, the hindsight 2020 thing doesn't work. It would have been a disaster under anybody. One of the things that I'm really hopeful for coming out of the Donald Trump years is that the Republican foreign policy would not backslide into what it used to be. Namely that he fundamentally changed the attitude of Republicans toward China, which I think is very clear. I mean, the tone is clearly different among, you know, anyone who has ambitions to higher office on the Republican side, but also that he changed their attitude toward the priority debate. That basically the priority ought to be what is in America's best interest at time and time again. And that to me can be better refined, but essentially it amounts to our friends should trust us, our enemies should fear us. We should use military power projection, not to do humanitarian nation building and the like, but focused on killing bad guys and getting and solving problems in that most violent of ways, which is what they do best. And that basically, you know, this is something that ought to reorient the conversation about foreign policy on the right. Do you believe that that's been achieved? Do you think there will be backsliding? And what do you think the sort of Republican foreign policy, and I mean this in broad terms, I mean, because it includes a lot of different views, but just broadly defined, what do you think it looks like going forward in a potentially post-Trump, or let's just assume post-Trump era?
Well, I think you put it really well. And I think President Trump deserves enormous credit for precisely the I mean, I got to tell you, when I was watching the debates and he said the Iraq war was a mistake, I literally got up and cheered. It was the first time a major Republican political figure had said it, what, 13, 12 years after the war. And the China thing, I think in 100 years, people will go and look back and say that was a critical moment. I mean, there are things you can certainly criticize him about, and such as like the kind of the mechanisms and the treatment of allies and the rhetoric and stuff like that. But I mean, on those basic fundamentals, those were tremendous and tectonic. And I mean, I think, you know, I go back to the quote, notionally, you know, the quote unquote Republican foreign policy of the 90s and 2000s. It was so unconservative. And, you know, again, not to sort of like make it like conservatism is perfection. But I mean, you know, it's basically the attitude, I think, that you take care of your primary responsibilities. You ensure that you're, you know, doing that, and you help others where you can. You work constructively, but in a kind of like a business-like way with others. You know, it's not a friendship. It's not, you know, everything's not humanitarian work. And I mean, I think Trump, in a lot of ways, he had a certain way where he would put a really sharp point on it. But I mean, to me, it should be an American self-interest, and there's nothing to apologize about that. I mean, only Kissinger has a great line that's like, only in America is an epithet to be called a realist. Well, I think only in America is it an epithet to say that you're looking after American citizens' self-interest. That is, that we should, even we in the Blob, we should be working for the American people. Now, yeah. I think where we go forward is, you know, I use the word enlightened, which is probably a little kind of flimsy, but it's basically the idea, like, you know, if you're in business, you want to have a reputation for good trust, long-term relationships. You want to work with other people. That's the kind of way you go. You don't pull out of NATO. You don't pull out of relationships, you know, willy-nilly. You do a good job. You on the whole, you should be steady, although sometimes it's really good to have a reputation for being unpredictable, as Kissinger and Eisenhower and Nixon used to point out. Mm-hmm. But I think that's, you know, that's good. What happens, you would have a better sense. I fear it. I mean, I see the people, the Bill Kristols of the world, being very active on Twitter. That worries me. But on the other hand, I mean, our situation is so bad. I mean, at home, it's so bad. And then in the geopolitical challenge from China. Now, you know, America is in a relatively good position compared to a lot of countries in the world. You know, it's basically us and the Chinese pulling ahead of others, but we have a ton of problems. And this is going to be a geopolitical competition like that, certainly since the Soviet Union. So I think there's going to be a focus, and the people, you know, I saw David French was out there calling for like responsibility to protect being resuscitated, which is just so delusional. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's such a detachment from the military reality where we might lose in the primary theater. So I think that's, and I'm really encouraged too to see Republican voters, their priority list, and an unabashed assertion of what's in Americans' interest. You know, I mean, you know, all the politicians and influential people like you. So I'm hopeful. I think what, you know, actually one of the things I'm really trying to do is think about what should this foreign policy look like? And I think it does involve allies in a more business-like and strategic context. And it is going to be a lot about allies. So we're going to need to equilibrate, if you will, how we talk about allies and overseas engagements, because, you know, and be more strategic and smart about it. But yeah, Fundamentally, we want to look at this through the prism of our long-term self-interest.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's incredible that a statement as upfront and basic as that should be at all controversial.
I know, it's sort of banal, right? It's like, sometimes I think to myself, "Is like, is this obvious?" And it's like, "That's not is the real problem." You know,
well, you know, it's you know, it's the equivalent. It's the equivalent of the old Herm Edwards line: "You play to win the game."
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. It's okay. It's not a crime.
Exactly. Elbridge Colby, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks, Ben. It was a pleasure.
So I just wanted to offer you a little bit of a perspective on what's been going on in Afghanistan. My own take is that the Biden administration is just shot through with a lot of people who are incredibly naive about the way that the world works. Unfortunately, we are in a position where that has resulted in America really losing its respect, the kind of appreciation for it around the world. In a way that is going to be exploited by our enemies and used against our friends. Now, whatever you think about American foreign policy, I think that one thing that we can all share is a belief that our friends should be able to trust us and our enemies should be fearing us. Unfortunately, that's not the kind of result of what President Joe Biden just achieved in Afghanistan. I really think that an exit under President Trump would have gone much better for a number of reasons. One is that he cares deeply about optics, and I do not think for an instant that he would have accepted the optical situation of leaving so much material, vehicles, and the like behind to be used by the Taliban. But I also believe that there really is an interest on the part of President Trump of sending the message that America can be trusted and America should be feared. What does that look like? Well, it looks like bringing our Afghan allies who have done so much work, whether it relates to interpreting people over the years or assisting us in other ways, out in a timely manner. And I certainly think that it also relates to making sure that the Taliban knows that they can't get away with everything that they want to do. Instead, now we are in a situation where the President of the United States is effectively begging the Taliban to allow people through in order to escape in an orderly fashion. That's unacceptable, and it's not something that Americans should stand by. The president's approval ratings are sinking rapidly. Kamala Harris is laughing her way through various obvious questions. This is not a good scenario for this administration. It's one that looks increasingly out of step with what Americans want. And that is going to be a significant political effect in terms of what it means for the midterms and what it means for the Democratic Party going forward. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
Guy Benson, join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.